Hello everyone, I am Jessica Saxton, the Environmental Education Outreach Leader through United Communities AmeriCorps and the host of Living Downstream. Umpqua Watersheds values both human and ecological diversity. We acknowledge that the land upon which Umpqua Watersheds is located was formerly occupied and tended by various indigenous groups, including Cow Creek Umpqua, Coquille, Mulala, and others. Their history is intertwined with this place, and we seek to continue to practice stewardship and reciprocity towards the natural environment which indigenous people did for thousands of years prior to European settlement. We celebrate the strengths and perspectives that different people have to offer, and believe that organizations, communities, and ecosystems are all more resilient when they embrace the unique gifts various individuals can contribute. Welcome. Thank you for joining us on this episode of Living Downstream. Today, I have Teresa Barber with Oregon Wild Horse Organization to talk about the wild horses in Oregon. Thank you for joining us. Could you introduce yourself and provide some information about OWHO?
Sure. Thank you for having me. So, you know, I'm Teresa Barber. People who know me and follow me online follow me as Val Sakamahogset, and that's a long, convoluted explanation as to why I don't have my legal name on Facebook. But at any rate, OWHO, or Oregon Wild Horse Organization, was formed in 2022 after me attempting to retire when I resigned from another horse organization. I retired for about 8 months and couldn't stand it, so it had a lot of pressure from some people that live in Oregon to form an organization that was based more on protecting the horses here in Oregon. And, you know, my own personal experience with, you know, decades of wild horse advocacy, I knew that it would be a national advocate organization. But we did go ahead and start OWHO, and soon enough, everybody realized you can't get protections for Oregon wild horses without fighting at a national level, because the laws that govern their management are federal laws. So OWHO does a few things. We primarily seek to bring awareness through educating the public, teaching people how to be good advocates. And then we also litigate where we see that the laws are broken, and there's a lot of that happening with the two federal agencies that manage wild horses. And then we also spend time communicating with our congressional members where we're asking for an investigation into the management of our wild equines, an overhaul of the program that more accurately reflects the wild horse status as a native species, and incorporate the current climate crisis and what needs to be done to help the horses along as the climate changes.
Wonderful. Thank you. It sounds like you guys are doing a lot of great work.
I have a great team. So,
so roughly how many wild horses and burros currently reside on public lands, and who manages them?
Well, wild horses and burros, like I said, are federally protected. And when the law was passed in 1971, it's called the Wild Free Roaming Horses and Burros Act. They put two federal agencies in charge of managing them on public lands. That was primarily because those agencies already managed those areas of public lands. So it became the Bureau of Land Management, or BLM, and the Forest Service. And BLM manages, what they tell you is they manage 177 herd management areas in 10 Western states for wild horses and burros. Forest Services manages about 34, what they call territories. And, you know, I said they tell you that because, especially in the case of BLM, they say there's 177 herd management areas. However, some of those areas don't have horses, or the population's been zeroed out. So to say that they're managed for wild horses is just kind of fraud. And that's one of the things that we're trying to change. And they claim that there are, Forest Service says that they have roughly 51 wild horses and 900 burros. And BLM says that there are Roughly 65,000 wild horses with 18,000 burros that are out there. And that was their statistics in March of 2022. They don't put out their statistics till a little bit later for 23. So that'll be the most current information that they have. And when we look at the population that they claim is out there, BLM does this survey. They do aerial surveys most of the time. And then they add a percentage on to what they actually saw because they say, well, this is the percent that we likely missed, that were under trees or under rocks formations or whatever that we didn't see. And what we've seen for years is that number is really inflated. So do we believe that there are 64,000 horses left out there? No, not even. And one of the things that we saw in the past couple of years is when they go out and they do a gather, they'll say there's this many horses out there, and we've got to remove this many. When the gather's done, we see that they don't even remove the number that they claim were out there. They're not. Those horse numbers are so inflated that they can't even find that many horses anymore to remove. So we don't really know how many horses are out there because the surveys are biased and exaggerated. And so unless you can actually get people out there that can do their own surveys, you don't know. There are a few areas that we have great ground crews and we know how many horses are out there, but that's pretty rare when you're talking about 177 areas just with BLM alone.
It would be amazing to have that many wild horses, but having an accurate accounting would be much better.
Yeah, it's just like the land usage. It'd be nice if we knew the exact amount of land they're actually allowing them to use.
So, can you explain what the gathering is?
A gathering is when BLM goes out to a specific herd area, or sometimes several, if they do what they call a complex gather. And they will, most of the time, use helicopters to chase the horses into trap sites. And that's when they will remove most of the horses. Sometimes a few are put back out there. And the ones that are put back out there now, most of the time, are either gelded stallions, so they're no longer reproducing, or they're using fertility control drugs on them. And their new one is that they want to use IUDs in mares. And the fertility control are things like TZP and Gonacon. And then they have these IUDs. I don't know what's going on with the new IUDs. We're doing some research in it right now. We believe that they've got some kind of fertility control product on them that may be sterilizing horses. And we know that Gonacon does the same thing, and BLM's admitted it does. So basically, they're sterilizing horses and sticking them back out there.
There's no policies or laws that prevent them from doing that.
No, in fact, the Wild Horse and Burro Act said that they could sterilize some of the horses. What they're supposed to follow is the guidance of their own geneticist, was a Dr. Gus Cothran, who said that in order for a herd to be genetically self-sustaining or viable, that there should be at least 150 to 200 breeding horses in a herd. They never follow that because they claim that if the genetics start looking bad, they start seeing some inbreeding, they can just introduce horses from another area. What that's done is take away any of the little pockets of unique genetics that we had. And it also tends to take away more of what we call old world traits. And some of those old world traits that you don't see in a horse that's standing in a pasture are things like the leg barring you'll see on their legs. They have these black stripes. And most of the time, the wild horses were done in coloration. They had a dorsal stripe. Sometimes there was some striping in the manes. They have thicker necks, more muscled fronts. So they did definitely a different look than most of what we call the pasture pet breeds. They're taking a lot of those out and watering down those genetics. So we're concerned about the genetics and the way they've been managed with the horses, but there are no definitive laws or policies about that.
Thank you. Do you know what the wild horses are classified? Like, are they actually classified as a wild horse, or Are they trying to classify them as a quarter horse or a thoroughbred? Like, do you know the genetics?
Okay, well, while all horses are classified as Equus caballus, right? That's the species of modern horse. And that's been the case since the end of the Pleistocene epoch. So it's the horse that was here when they claim that horses went extinct, and it's the horse that's here now. And everything else is a breed. So they're all the same species, but things like quarter horse, saddlebred, Morgan, they're all breeds. Wild horses that they associate with the wild horses that were first reintroduced in this extinction theory that they have are ones that they say were reintroduced by the Spanish. So when they do genetics, the things that they look for to say that they have these old world traits are what they call Spanish markers. And those are the physical traits I just told you about. But any
Okay.
horse that's born in the wild and not dependent on humans is considered wildlife, a wild horse, and that's by law. So you get into two different areas. You get into a determination of wild versus feral, which is an escaped animal that turned wild. And wildlife is an animal that was born in the wild and doesn't depend on humans. So this distinction of wildlife versus a feral animal is a legal definition. And yes, they have legally been determined to be wildlife. The definition over native versus invasive, which would get into what species they are, when they were here, and when they weren't here, all of that is a scientific determination. And I'll probably get into that with more questions that you have, I would guess.
Yes. So since we're talking about it, are the wild horses and burros native to the continental US?
The very simple answer to that is yes, they are. Equine family originated in North America and nowhere else. They evolved here for over 50 million years. They dispersed across every inch of contiguous dry land on the planet, supposedly going across the Bering Land Bridge. And there's no other explanation for how they got there. So we believe that. To imagine that the horses became extinct here but survived everywhere else is pretty absurd, and it's rapidly being debunked. In addition to numerous mid-Holocene fossils and historical records, Native American traditional knowledge, recent advances in genome technology, paleontology place horses in North America to around 1,000 years before present. Which is something they call YBP. And there's studies that were being done at McMaster University in Ontario, and they're the preeminent research institution in the field of ancient DNA. And there were three different people with PhDs. There was Tyler Murchie, Hendrik Pointer, and then, of course, Dr. Ross McPhee, who's the from the American Museum of Natural History. And they were able to splice DNA from Yukon and Alaskan sediment that placed horses at the site to as recently as 5,700 to 4,500 YBP, or years before present. And then the one thing that was really notable in some of their finds were that other large ungulate species that are considered native appeared to decline in population density at those sites earlier or at the same rate as horses. But these native animals are still here. Horses are still here, but not considered native. So McMaster University research is still ongoing and reconstructing the view of post-Pleistocene ecosystems and their interrelationships as they caused and responded to change. Then in central Mexico, Wade Miller, who's another PhD, and his team documented a continuum of horse evidence from tens of thousands of years ago to around 900 to 1,000 YBP. And they've tentatively identified a primary species as Equus mexicanus. But it's important to note there that Equus caballus, or modern horse, is thought to encompass other strains as breed differentiations rather than separate species. And Dr. Jake Kirkpatrick, who has passed now, but he specifically listed Equus mexicanus as belonging to the species Equus caballus. So establishing the native species, or the native species status of horses in America is important from a policy standpoint, though even endangered species do not necessarily enjoy the intended protections of the Endangered Species Act, but policy isn't the end game. As a native species evolving with their respective micro environments, wild horses need to be returned to their role in restoring resiliency and functionality, especially to Western ecosystems.
Wonderful, thank you. So, currently, is there enough public lands for the wild horses and burros to reside on?
Yeah, obviously. I say obviously. Everybody else would, that doesn't like horses would say, no way. So in 1971, when the act was passed, they had to designate all the areas where wild horses lived at that time. And I always say horses, and I mean horses and burros. So if I don't add the in burros, infer it, please. what they did, so in 1971, the act passed, they had to map out the areas where wild horses and burros lived. And so they came up with about 54 million acres, just a little less than that, that they said that they lived on. Right now, the land that's managed for them, but not necessarily with horses on it, is about 27 million acres. So they now have about half their land. And what they did is they claimed that there was a little less than 27,000 wild horses and burros in 1971. So BLM has based their national population level or maximum number there can be on a national level for the 10 Western states. This doesn't include wild horses in the East, like the Assateague, the Chincoteague, Corolla. It's just the 10 Western states that BLM manages. So what they say is that because there was only that 27,000 in 1971, that's what they have to manage for. However, BLM's contradicted that and said that they really had no idea how many horses they had in 1971. In fact, we found places where they testified to Congress and in court cases that there was probably a whole lot more than that in 1971. The first census was done in 1973, and that showed that there were 60,000 wild horses and burros. And because it's generally known and accepted that wild horse populations will increase by about 20% a year, it's biologically impossible that they would have gone from 27,000 in 1971, and it was December of 1971. So it was really kind of 1972. And then by the time the census was done in 73, would have 60,000. So you're saying that they went from a little less than 30,000 to 60,000 in a little over a year, when they have generally accepted that they double in 5 years. So how did they do it in a little over a year back then? So we know that that 27,000 is a lie. We've seen it. We've seen them testify to it scientifically, biologically. It's impossible for it to have been there. So what we end up doing, in essence, is, by acquiescing to that national AML or population level, it's an appropriate management level or an AML. They're saying that we're willing to take this wild horse and burro population down to numbers that were potentially even lower than when Wild Horse Annie, who's the person responsible for getting the act passed to protect the horses, her real name was Velma Johnston, but everybody knows her as Wild Horse Annie. So we're saying that, if you take the horses down to that number, really, you're taking it down to less than there were in 1971 when Congress said they were fast disappearing. And they unanimously passed a law to protect them. So they knew the horses were in trouble at a number that was even higher than it likely is right now. So our problems are more about the underlying assumptions that we need to get that nationwide number down to 26,000, or that we're overpopulated, or that we don't have too many livestock, because we do. So is there land? Yes, there's plenty of land. The problem is it's overgrazed by commercially owned livestock.
So we talked a bit about the gathering and kind of rounding them up. What are your thoughts on horses being captured and being auctioned off?
Number one, our main goal is on-range management. So we don't think they should ever be gathered and removed and sold or adopted. And once a wild horse is removed from the wild, they're never guaranteed safety ever. When they're sold or adopted, they lose their federal protections and they can be disposed of however the owner sees fit because they become property. And that includes going to slaughter. So you'll hear BLM say things like, well, we don't sell to anyone who intends to, use them for commercial purposes. In other words, send them to slaughter. And they'll say that, adopters can't do that and blah, blah, blah. But the simple matter of fact is it's not legally enforceable. And that's why when BLM got caught and sold this guy, Tom Davies, a large number of wild horses, and then he took them to slaughter. Nothing happened because it's not legally enforceable. What be the most BLM can do is take a person off of their sale or adoption list and deny them because they've done something bad with the horses. That's the most that can actually be done. So we don't believe that that adoption and sales program is safe. And in 2022, there were 7,793 horses and burros that were placed into private care, either through adoption, sale, or transfer. And that, if you compare that to the 20,193 that were gathered in just 2022 alone, that's not very many being placed into good homes that may not even be good homes. The rest of them live out their lives in long-term holding or off-range pastures. And as of May of 2022, there were 58,314 living in off-range or long-term pastures. And one of my biggest issues with that is BLM's budget. For 2021, which is the most recent stats I could find this morning, the expenditures for BLM's total budget for 2021 was $122 million, roughly. And their off-range holding costs were 64% of that. And then their placement into private care through adoptions and sales was another 12%. And then just the gathering of the animals was another 7%. So if you add those three things up, that are gathering, removing them from the wild, and placing them somewhere else, that's a total of 83% of their budget. So, how much are they actually expending to manage these animals on the range? Not much. 12% of their budget went into, their program overhead, and only 5% went into any kind of fertility control. So they could be using the product that we always advocate for is a product called PZP, and that's the short acronym for it. But it's a safe birth control. It's what they've used in Assateague for over 40 years. It's reversible. It does not sterilize the mares. It doesn't cause deformities of foals, which is something you hear from advocates who think that, horses should never be touched by humans. And unfortunately, we've screwed up this ecosystem so bad. We have to interfere at this point. So, to only apply 5% to fertility control that keeps horses out on the range is ludicrous. It's just absolutely ridiculous when you're spending 83% of your budget to get rid of animals from the range that are native, that are good for the environment, that should be out there. So, you asked specifically about auction. Wild horses are put up for adoption and sale too, and that's most often through online events. And I don't know who in their right mind purchases or adopts a horse or burro from an online website. And there's this romanticism of owning a wild horse, and it leads a lot of people to adopt and buy these animals. And most of the time, I can tell you, adopters have no idea what they're getting into. These animals are not pasture pets. They weren't born in a situation where they were around humans and depend on them for daily care. So their first exposure is very often this really violent gather where they're being stampeded by a helicopter and shoved into a pen, and it's little family units that aren't usually together. So they're all shoved into this trap site. They start fighting with each other. They're terrified. And what do they associate with that? A human. So when you put them into a situation where they're adopted by a human, it takes a lot of work to get them to trust you. And a lot of people don't know how to train an animal like that. So they end up, waiting till they get their title, or, if they bought them, they already have it, and they ship them off to auction because they're just not something that these people can handle. And that happens a lot. So they are never safe once they're off the range.
That's really unfortunate. I know I had looked at those auction sites at one point and I couldn't fathom purchasing a horse online. Like,
No,
I would
who
need to
does
be in,
that?
I would need to be in person. Like, I didn't understand. And my horse is a rescue horse, and
Right.
it took years to help her after so much abuse from humans.
Right, yeah, that's exactly right.
Yeah, I
So
couldn't
you can
imagine.
imagine how they feel like they've been abused by these humans in the helicopter and shoved into trucks and everything else. And so yeah, it's not a safe situation for any of them.
Yeah. What do you specifically focus on regarding the public lands? We talked a bit about different topics in the BLM. What do you guys push for or advocate for? When it comes to wild equines on public lands, like specifically.
I think our main focus, especially in the last couple of years, has been the deviation from what the Wild Horse and Burro Act originally said. I mean, the original act was very clear. It wasn't ambiguous at all, especially when you considered the intent of Congress to protect, what they call the fast disappearing species. And so some of the things that we want to see are repatriation of those lands that were removed from the program. And not just left in the program, because they'll still list what they call herd areas, which were the original big areas, but they only manage the horses on a portion of those areas, that's called a herd management area or HMA. And the reason for that is because, FLIPMA, or the Federal Land Policy Management Act, was passed after. And it said that public lands had to be managed for multiple uses. So what BLM did was they said, oh, okay, we've got this big area. And it was originally called the range with, a lowercase r. Well, when the act got passed, we saw tons of interviews when we go through the historic records. There are tons of interviews from these ranchers that went, they're going to turn the whole area into this big wild horse sanctuary. And, so they were worried about horses having principal use of those vast areas. So when FLIPMA happened and it said multiple uses, BLM said, oh, okay, well, we've got to manage principally for wild horses on these areas. They call it the range. Okay, we're going to call three areas in the country a range with the capital R for horses and one for burros. And then they defined the range and said that's the area where we're going to manage principally for the horses. All the rest of them we're going to call herd areas. And because we have this new law, FLIPMA, that says we have to manage for multiple uses, we're going to take those herd areas and we're going to draw a little circle over in the corner here. And that's going to be the herd management area where we're going to actually let the horses be. And the rest of the herd area is going to be for those other multiple uses. But even with that, those little herd management areas, are even managed for multiple uses. So they don't even get full use of those areas. So a big part of our problem is that there's so much demand for the public lands. And it's not all livestock either. There are also the extractive industries with oil and gas, and, you know, lithium has become a huge thing now, other precious metals, solar and wind farms, recreation. So there's a lot of people that want a piece of the public lands that the wild horses and burros are allocated under the act. So we want current management practices evaluated, and we want that on-range management instead of the continuation of the past 50 years of roundup, remove, repeat. And, you know, all serious wild horse advocate associations, you know, would never say that we don't need fertility control or population. We do know that because, you know, back in the old days when nature was balanced, we had apex predators that kept those populations in check. But we've wiped out the majority of those predators. And you hear BLM say that horses have no natural predators. That's not true. They have wolves, bears, mountain lions, and even coyotes now that will prey on the horses. And they're seeing coyotes hunt in packs to bring down horses in some instances. So those have been some of our main focuses. So we don't just advocate for the horses. We advocate for other wildlife. We know we need the predators out there. We know that they need to be healthy too. And one of our big fights, I think I might have talked to you at the PILC conference recently, the law conference, about Gonicon. And one of our lawsuits currently is over the use of Gonicon, because Gonicon's not been researched well enough, or at least we've not seen it. We have asked for the research that was submitted to get it approved by the EPA as a pesticide. And that FOIA request or public records request is about a year and a half old now, and they've still not answered it. And what we're afraid of is that because it's a sterilant, it's not just a birth control, and BLM will even admit that they don't know when or if horses or burros would return to fertility once they stop giving it. We do know it'll instantly sterilize a stallion. We do know that it sterilizes mares. We don't know how many doses of Gonicon it takes to sterilize the mare, whether or not, you know, or how many are sterilized with the first dose. So there's just not enough research about it. But the scariest thing for me was that we don't know if that horse is eaten by a predator, whether it, you know, is taken down by the predator and then eaten, or whether it dies out there and carrying consumers like vultures or eagles would eat that flesh, whether or not it could sterilize them. And then there's the other big issue is that if a horse treated with Gonicon is removed from the range eventually and ends up in the slaughter pipeline, how safe is it for a human to be eating an animal that's been treated with Gonicon? Those studies aren't there. We've been bringing it up for over a year. BLM's never refuted it and said, here's the studies, it's safe. And if you look at the EPA labels for those products, they're horrible. And they're not just giving it to horses. They're using it on prairie dogs. They're using it on deer and elk. So, you know, my thing there is hunters beware. You don't know what you're feeding your family anymore. So I think that we need some answers about Gonicon, and very quickly.
We talked a bit about how ranchers depend on livestock grazing for their livelihood. Are wild horses and burros creating undue hardship on their operations?
Well, first, it's important to note that today's livestock producers aren't the ma-and-pa small family ranches that first came west and started ranching outfits, right? Most of them are now huge corporations. The ranches that are adjacent to the grazing permitted area of the public land is often a hired ranch manager. So they're not these generational families that have been out there ranching for years. So you're not taking out a small mom-pa organization or a small mom pa outfit. In most cases, it's a big corporation. And some of these big corporations have over 2 million acres that they're running cattle on our public lands. That's not a small mom pa ranch. And then when you talk about the fact that right now there's that estimated 2 million livestock on public lands and only about 60,000 wild horses, we don't feel there's an issue for livestock at all. So then the issue becomes why are they saying that, right? Why are they saying that wild horses are such a problem? And we think that the bigger issues for livestock producers are environmental changes from both decades of overgrazing and the current climate crisis, both of which created this drought and lack of forage. And so the other threat to livestock producers are also the conservation efforts for other native wildlife species like sage grouse, and a plethora of smaller animals, the desert tortoise and spotted owls, and a lot of rodent species and fish. And, so we could go on and on with that one. But this increased desire to use public lands for recreation and extractive industries, and so all of these threats, are apparent to livestock producers. And when you get organizations, especially ones that are fighting for other wildlife, they look at all that damage out there and they look at the livestock, right? So the livestock industry has done so much damage by overgrazing that they need a scapegoat for all that damage. So the horses, because they're not an interest for hunters, so they're not a game species like elk or deer, and horses aren't seen as native. So, they don't get the protection that wolves and bears and eagles get. So the horses become this convenient animal to blame for damages. So no, wild horses and burros don't cause an undue hardship for ranchers. There's plenty of room out there.
Thank you for explaining that. Could you tell a bit about the negative contribution of cows to our climate crisis versus wild horses and how they differ?
Sure. So livestock on public lands isn't just a horse issue, it's a climate issue. And livestock on public lands include sheep as well as cattle. But cattle are the more abundant livestock species out there. And cattle differ greatly from horses and burros. Cattle are ruminants, they have four stomachs, they chew their cud. Horses and burros only have a single stomach. So cattle eat and digest their food, which slowly produces a nitrogen-rich slurry or poop that sits on surface soil. Unless it's broken up and scattered, it prevents any plant growth. And the way horses and burros digest their food, the resulting dung or poop isn't as broken down. So it results in this bolus. It's a perfect little seed package ready to grow the following season. The major difference is the level of CH4 gases or methane. And more cattle and producing alfalfa to feed them contributes to the CH4 and other greenhouse gases. And, we cited a study in one of our papers that found that emissions by cattle are approximately 71 kilograms of CH4 methane per capita per year by grazing cattle. And on top of the methane comparisons, cows and horses should be compared for their ability to sequester carbon or CO2. And there was a good article that was by this Mason Jones, David Mason Jones, and it was in Hoofbeats. And they said that a horse is a carbon sink. That interestingly, he states that the biomass of a horse is a carbon sink in the same way as the biomass of a tree in a forest is a carbon sink. The digestive process of horses produces far less methane than the digestive system of cattle and sheep. Cattle and sheep are, and certain other grazing animals are known as ruminants because of their gut. It contains a rumen. Rumen is part of a ruminant's digestive system that breaks down tough grasses that are found in natural pastures and out in the wild. In breaking down the tough grasses, the bacteria in the rumen release large amounts of methane gases. So the rumen animal then belches out that methane gas. So horses aren't a ruminant. Their digestive system of a horse can't break down those tough grasses as a cow or sheep can. So a horse has that single stomach. It can only deal with easily digestive carbohydrates in the grasses. And they're also selective grasses, grazers. They don't eat the tougher grasses because they know they can't digest them. So they simply produce less methane in their digestive system. One of the other big things is the water riparian areas, right? Approximately 80% of the damage to streams and riparian ecosystems has been caused by livestock grazing in the Western United States. So that's a huge issue for these animals. And there was one study that we found that talked about even the cow urine. The cow urine is real high in nitrogen, so that accumulates in the soil, leaches or washes off in the waterways. And that causes problems with the nitrogen and growth of the algal blooms that kill a river, and also fewer nutrients available for plant and animal growth because of that. Additionally, cattle are able to easily decimate riparian areas. Cattle and horses have similar bone structures, but the main difference is that cattle have twice the amount of hoof structures because they have split hooves or two toes, and twice the ability to do damage because those toes are sharper, more pointed toes, almost like a shovel that digs into those soil crusts. And when we looked at riparian areas, especially in Oregon, there was a well-known hydrologist, this Wayne Elmore, and there was a book that was put out by Lynn Jacobs. It's called Waste to the West, and it was published in 1991. And it was about public lands ranching. And Wayne said in this that many people have never seen a healthy rangeland riparian area since degradation was widespread before many of us were even born. In the same publication, another riparian specialist, this Harold Weinger, said that usable water could be increased by about 190,000 acre feet on Oregon's Ochoco National Forest simply by removing cattle for 10 years. And that with only 5 years of no grazing on the Ochoco, fishery production could be expected to increase by 150%. That's with no cattle for 5 years. Then you can look at the irrigation permits that were issued in Oregon. And most of that's for alfalfa growth. And we found so many articles that talked about how bad these permits were and how they were just so large and so there were so many of them that they were literally draining the aquifers in eastern Oregon, and it was causing even like the Malheur Lake that's needed because it's part of a migratory bird area. It's just causing them to drop by almost an inch a year, which is massive. And this alfalfa doesn't stay in the country. Neither do these cattle that we're raising. They don't stay in this country. They're exported. And so how are we putting America first in this? We're not. We're destroying our lands. We're destroying our waters. We're destroying our wildlife. Why? To put cattle out there. So the these articles and that were put out, there was an actual whistleblower that had been part of the organization that issued the water permits in Eastern Oregon, and he came out and talked about all this. And one of the big things was that they were basing a lot of their studies that supported them giving these permits out on a study done in 1968 by the USGS. It's so severely outdated. Why were they using it? Because there just isn't anything else available. It's ridiculous.
Yeah, and why wouldn't they do a new study
It's a good
to have?
question.
Yeah.
It's a good question. So, and that's one of the problems we see with a lot of the scientific studies that BLM uses is that they're so seriously outdated. We just refuted one that was from 1981 on wild horse behavior, and it was so ridiculous. BLM claimed that study supported their statement that wild horses, when there's scarce water, will chase other wildlife away from water sources. And so I went and I looked through this study. The whole study was about how stallions fight with other stallions. It had nothing to do with other wildlife weren't even mentioned in it. But yet they use that and they assume that nobody's going to read these studies. So they say their scientists are unrefuted. Well, why is that? It's because we as an advocacy haven't done our due diligence. We haven't done our homework. We're not checking all their facts. And that's one of the big things that OWHO strives to do is get their hands on these studies. And BLM does not want to give you the studies. They list them, they're not available. That's a legal issue that we fight with them on all the time. You know, that if they reference something, it has to be reasonably accessible to the public. That's in the NEPA laws, the National Environmental Policy Act. And then it's also in their handbook, even, that these materials have to be reasonably available. BLM has decided that reasonably available can mean that if it's not available online, you have to drive to the field office that put the environmental assessment out and read them. Well, if I'm in Oregon and I'm fighting a wild horse action in, you know, New Mexico, it's not reasonably available if I have to drive to Nevada to read the study. But that's what they're trying to do. So we're fighting that on a legal level now too. And I didn't tell you, but we have five open lawsuits right now against BLM. Five. So we are busy.
I wish you luck with those.
Thank you.
That's a lot of work.
It is.
I'm surprised that BLM is not required to have their findings more accessible in their information because, as a college student myself, trying to find research and studies is very difficult with the BLM. The information's not accessible.
Yeah, their transparency issues and accessibility issues have gotten worse. And you know, there's a lot of places where you know, someone will out BLM for some of their statistics or whatever, and they'll do it using their own pages. Like we've done that in a couple of our papers. And what BLM routinely does is go take down all of that stuff so you can't find it anymore. So it's intentional. And that's a huge issue within BLM. And until we can get Congress to see what's going on, because who has ultimate oversight over BLM? It's Congress. And until we can get them to wake up and see how corrupt this is and what's going on, we aren't going to be able to make those changes. So it's a thing that all of us should be speaking up about.
So we've talked a bit about BLM. Are they where you see your most opposition, or do you see it in other places as well?
Well, BLM is a big part of the opposition because they're the managers, right? But like I said, ultimately, that oversight is done by Congress. Congress is the one who can say, hey, knock it off, or they can amend the law or change the law. And then obviously you have livestock producers too. And so one of the things that ends up happening is that one of the things that ends up happening is we're fighting livestock producers, obviously. So yeah, I would say that they were one of our biggest, you know, components to protect the horses. But then you have these land managers, and the land managers being BLM or Forest Service are often people who grew up on the ranches out there. they live in those areas, they get hired, they do those jobs, and those are the ones that are the local managers making the decisions. Do you have people that were brought in from other places and, you know, have the state level jobs? Yeah, you do, but they don't have that day-to-day decision-making job and pretty much go along with the other stuff. And some of the states, they're so much rural activity that you still run into that same, you know, kind of good old boy attitude. And we run into that a lot. So it's a huge conflict of interest managing the wild horses and burros. And, you know, the BLM was originally set up to manage livestock. That's what their job was. So to now throw in wild horses who were already not seen as an important animal to livestock producers, you really threw them into an agency where there was a conflict of interest to begin with. So that's a big part of our problem. But again, my major blame in all this is Congress, because they're not doing their job. They're not performing oversight on this agency, and the corruption is rampant.
Do you be willing to provide a little bit of information about upcoming events, trainings, and opportunities, or people, ways that people can get involved and learn more?
Sure. So what we've been doing is we do a weekly PIM, or a public information meeting, and we do them on Zoom. And the whole, you know, anybody in the public is invited to join. And I always do a question and answer session. Sometimes they're more formal and I'll do a presentation and then allow questions and answers. Sometimes they're a lot less formal and we'll work through current issues or topics that come up and basically spend our time talking with the public on it. So they're pretty relaxed. And then we've also put together these team where we work on, we do longer workshops on Zoom, and we work on things like public comments for current environmental assessments, which are usually plans to gather the horses. And then we'll work on legislative documents or publications that we're going to distribute to, you know, at events that we go to and stuff like that. So we have this team that we have established that works on things like that with us. And typically, you know, we encourage people to come to those PIMs on Fridays and get to know us, look at our website, look at the things that interest you, and before you say, yeah, let's jump into this. And we do those PIMs every Friday at 5 o'clock Pacific Standard Time, and people can write us or ask to be on our mailing list just for those invites. We don't use them for anything else. We don't solicit for donations or any of that stuff. It's just for these invites to Zoom. And if you want to email, that would be owho.pim@gmail.com. Or you can give us a call. And the office number is 541-315-6650. And if somebody's interested in volunteering, you don't have to be from Oregon. You don't have to be local. You can be. But there's plenty of stuff that people across the nation can do. We even have some members that are in other countries that help. And what I would say is check us out. Like I said, we do most of our stuff on Facebook still. We do have a Twitter account, but we're not very active there. And then we do have our website, which is oregon-wildhorse.org. And look those things over. See what we do. See what area interests you the most. You know, I have a great team. Like I said, we have writers, we have researchers, we have a youth director, we have a legal consultant, we have photographers who go out and document, we have water haulers who have hauled in times of drought where we can get permits. The thing we need the most in Oregon is boots on the ground. I mean, we just don't have those people out in Eastern Oregon that can go document these herds and document what the land looks like out there. So we can use them in any of the Western states, but Oregon's been really short supply of volunteers who can get out there. So that would be a huge one in Oregon specifically. And then the other big one is lawyers. We desperately need lawyers who can work inexpensively or even pro bono. There's two or three lawyers in the country that people use for wild horse issues. And that's it. That's absolutely it. So with OWHO, we typically represent ourselves, and it's a lot of work. It's a lot of work. And I've been doing it for a lot longer than OWHO's been in existence. I was working with another organization, another nonprofit called Citizens Against Equine Slaughter for about 10 years before that. And I started doing these cases when I was with them. So, and I by no means am anywhere close to a lawyer. I do my best, and I think I do a pretty good job. But we would love to have some lawyers step in and say, "Hey, what can we do to help you?" We can even do a lot of the work for them. So it would be great. And then, of course, the other thing is funding. We can always use funding. Even though we don't have lawyers that we're paying, even when we represent ourselves, it still gets expensive to do these lawsuits. So, people can donate directly or even volunteer to do fundraisers. We've had some great quilters in the past who have, made a horse themed quilt and given it to us to auction off. And so things like that can be done too. So I would say, find your niche within our organization, and we are there, and we are happy to help you find your niche. And I would say there's not a person in our organization that's not people friendly. So jump in.
Thank you. So do you have any other information you would like to provide to the audience?
Just that wild horses and burros need you. They need you to get involved and be a voice for them. And all of us who are fighting for wild lands and wild spaces and wildlife have a common foe in this. We all want to see livestock removed from these spaces because they're a common thread that causes the damage and the losses that we're seeing today. So get involved. We need everybody. And of course, I want to thank you for having me and, giving us your ears for this time.
Of course, I really appreciated having you guys on the show, and I will definitely keep in the know of what's going on. And I hope sometime in the future I can volunteer with you guys because I would love to go over there and be boots on the ground for some operations.
And we would absolutely love to have you. Well, thank you so much.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Living Downstream.